Live from the Talking Joe Studios,
it's Talking Joe.
Talking Joe is on the air.
Hey, hey, hey. You are watching Talking Joe live and direct, coming to you via the YouTubes or Facebook or even Twitter. I am Mark, and today we are going to be talking all about the latest Kickstarter from the fine folks at the After Action Report. And we will be joined by Roger very shortly to tell us all about the book, the Kickstarter, what to expect, and all that good stuff. But I will not be doing it alone. As normal, I will be joined by Tim Finn.
Hello,
who's
Mark.
He's been hiding under his desk all this time.
And hello, listeners, viewers.
So let's bring in Roger, who is here to tell us all about his latest project. What is he doing?
Well, since he was doing dramatic, I thought I'd do dramatic.
Wow. Sort of like the camera. It's like the camera starting high on a full moon, tilts down, silhouetted C-130 to the signature outline of a Cobra castle parapet, and then Roger's head.
That's it. And true to our subject, the silent interlude, Josh will apparently remain silent for this interview.
Are you saying that he's actually in your home office pantomiming in the background?
If he is, he's doing a very good job.
He's in an oubliette dungeon. Yeah. Whoa, man, how'd I end up here?
Josh Eggebean, After Action Report. The thing about all these variant covers is one in 100 I got on eBay for just $85.
That's pretty close.
Excellent. Roger, let's before we get too deep into it, tell us about a little bit about the space that you're in today. You've got all sorts of interesting stuff behind you.
This is my bedroom. We got sci-fi collectibles over here, mostly vintage pre-Star Wars stuff, and the wall of G.I. Joe artwork. All sorts of cool stuff over there. And oh, look, After Action Report books right there.
Oh, funny that.
Yeah. But yeah, mostly just almost all of its artwork that I picked up personally. It's almost all original artwork, with the exception of the sightline print up there. But I had a hand in that because I helped to. I art directed it with Jason Marksell. Sorry. Throwing off my words here. But yeah, I helped to lay out that before it was released. And that was given out free when we gave out the sightline figure at one of the G.I. Joe conventions. So
it's awesome.
Got a painting up there of one of the adventure team sailors, I believe.
And then just over your left shoulder, you have previous After Action Report book publications.
Yes. Yeah. Those are just
for our viewers who don't know what After Action Report is. There have been three books, and each of these three books is different. What are they?
Volume one is G.I. Joe comic guide from 82 to 96. And that covers all of the English editions of everything that was printed throughout the world, from Marvel all the way through Dark Horse. Same thing for Devil's Due, and that's from 2001 to 2008. That covers everything Devil's Due published, including the few Mexican release issues they did, and everything the club released at that time. And Volume 3, we are hoping to say, yes, it's on the boat in the next week, which... we're pretty sure it will be. We're really, really crossing our fingers. We have had some advanced copies at Assembly Required, and that covers IDW's Larry Hama's run from 155 and a half to 300.
And each of these three books that you both just held up have new cover art by recognized G.I. Joe artists, right?
Yes. Rod Wiggum for issue one. Did 30 plus issues in the original run, and he did this sort of pseudo homage to the first issue with the tank in the middle and the Joes coming up around it. Back cover, Rod Wiggum did the art, and then Tom Feaster did the inking and coloring for us.
Tom Feaster, who worked on the first few issues of G.I. Joe Origins at IDW.
Yes, that would be correct. Josh Blaylock did our volume two cover, and they had Devils do his own crew do the inking and coloring on that. So not necessarily with the G.I. Joe content, but it was under Devils do nonetheless.
Close enough.
Yeah, exactly. Tim Seeley did the back cover for us. And that was Adam Ritchie's that did the coloring on that one.
And then the creme de la creme on volume three. Yes.
Larry Hama did the layout, the drawing essentially, finished off by Steve Lealoa, and colors by James Brown. And then the back was all Brian Sawyer. Brian Sawyer. Oh, and he did three different versions of Snake Eyes all wrapped.
And Shearer was an inker on the IDW run and also penciled and inked an issue or two all himself.
Yes, I believe that is correct.
Cool. Cool. So listeners, viewers, readers, if you want handy guides with a huge concentration of information all in an object that fits in your hand and on your shelf and is wrapped under beautiful covers and back covers with art by key G.I. Joe contributors through all eras. These books are for you. And then, Mark, you were holding up one more book, an ash can?
Yeah, so at the assembly required, I picked up the ash can for the latest in progress one, which was Command Files, which is very much in the tradition of Order of Battle.
Very much so, yes.
So each character profiles.
Each page is for a character, and when Mark says assembly required, he means the convention in November of 2023 held in Des Moines, Iowa.
Yes, that is correct. And that one was spearheaded by Greg Augustin, our other partner, and it's something he put together over the last... Hey, there he is. He's watching.
Since he's here, we're not going to do impressions of him.
Oh, damn. I had mine ready for it.
No, I'm but, doing I'm wearing a hat.
Yeah, hey, close. There you go. It's a step in the right direction. But yeah, he came up with the idea. He started the idea 10 years ago. Really, I think he's gone back to childhood with his idea. And just wanted a guide to cover all the more advanced character details that weren't quite stated in the file cards, a little more militaristic, and get down to the brass tacks of how they actually would function in a real military. And that's what ended up.
For me, the coolest thing about how this project has evolved is that you went out and commissioned some brand new art. So there's all of these great character shots new to the book.
Yes. We got, awesome. 33 new pieces of art for it. And most of the artists were directly involved with G.I. Joe at some point. Mark Pennington did several things, including the cover. And the cover's magnificent. It's got something like 26 characters on there.
For new people, Mark Pennington has not worked on Joe Comics, but was a figure designer at Hasbro.
That is correct.
Around 86, 87.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think he went up maybe into 88, right in around there.
Then he inked X-Men on Andy Kubert.
Hey, there you go.
if one of our viewers, listeners, wants to order some of these books, Roger, where do they go?
Currently, you can order volume one and two at afteractionreport.net. The Kickstarter that we're talking about today, the history of G.I. Joe number 21, that is currently on Kickstarter. We've got 12 more days left on it. And it's $793 over its goal, so it is going to be published. We'd like a few more people, but we've got enough to print it now. So, hopefully we'll reach a few stretch goals and get a few more things added to it. We've got stickers and dog tags, and it is, we've had dog tags in the past, but this will be all new dog tag for this one. If we reach that stretch goal. And Brian Sawyer is doing the cover for us. He's in charge of Assembly Required, the convention we spoke of earlier. And in his minimalistic style, we're also using his character designs for stickers that we're going to include as a stretch goal. Yeah, there is. That's his artwork right there for the cover. And that will be in full color when it's done.
I've seen the full color. It looks great.
Yes, it does. And that's just the preliminary full colors. We don't know what it's going to finally look like when it's done.
I haven't seen the colors. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, imagine this, but in color. So,
imagine this. It's one of the slogans from one of the GI Joe. It's from the 85 commercials, right? Where a kid goes, imagine this. And then they're all running on the deck of the flag.
I forget about that.
All right. So can you break down for us what are the sections of this book? Or Mark, did you have a more topical early question? Should we start with?
Yeah, my initial question would be, where did the impetus to create this book come from? Because we were talking not too long ago about what your next book might be, and I don't think it was this one. So it's obviously been shunted to the top of your list of what you want to do next.
This one was all Josh. I can't take credit for this one at all. He came up with it. He spearheaded it. Really, I think it comes down to his own obsession with G.I. Joe number 21. He just wanted to put together a book with, he was the one that came up with the search for 21 second printing a few years ago. The one that kind of preceded us doing these books as it was.
You're talking about an article, which was, it took a few months or years between one or two people figuring out if there was a G.I. Joe 21
second printing.
Print, because there was a third print.
Yes, there's a volume. There's a first print, which is obvious, direct market and newsstand edition. Those are first print editions. Excuse me. Then in the comic book three packs, they did reprints in those multi packs, and there is a G.I. Joe number 21 third print in there, but it's never really been firmly established where a second print would be. So the question is that a misprinted second print, or is there a second print in between one and three?
An earlier version of this essay has appeared in After Action Report, some of these guidebooks.
Yeah, but we have that in volume one. It originally appeared online at General's Joe's Reborn, and that was put out there and put out to the community to look through your long boxes and see what you can find and see if you open your 21s and see if there is one that's marked second printing, or if there's one that looks like a third printing but has something different about it. You know, if there's a different ad in it, or commonly if you look at the bullpen listing in the middle of the book, it'll show you what comics are coming out that month. And if it doesn't have that issue of G.I. Joe listed, you know, if you're holding a G.I. Joe 18 and it doesn't say G.I. Joe 18 in there, then it'll say like G.I. Joe number 32, and you'll have a reprint. And that'll be a good indicator that it's not the original printing. So if you can find one that has a different issue number in the bullpen, then that it would be the second printing, if we can find one that doesn't match the first or third printing. And so far, nobody's actually found that. But in volume three, Tommy Hazelton did some more research based on our initial article, and he found a lot more information about it. And we published an article by him about his conclusions as to why there is or isn't a volume two, a second printing.
So part of this new book about issue 21 is this essay. Mm-hmm. What else can readers find? Upcoming.
Josh scoured the internet for every possible reference to 21, and he's essentially assembled it into an appendix of everything that is known about it. We've condensed it down into every statement that Larry's ever made about it, everything Jim Shooter's ever said about it. And then we've referenced the book itself in terms of what's been reprinted, what's been homaged. So we'll have the silent issue from Deadpool. That'll be referenced in there. All the homage covers to it that have been done in either parody or just straight homage, those are all referenced in there in the same way that we've done the other books. But it is just a few pages since there's now nowhere near as many comics that are covered under that umbrella. We have articles about the impact of the book on pop culture and industry professionals. Few people, Tim Seeley, Josh Blaylock, Adam Ritchies, have all turned in short articles or statements about how they were influenced by the issue. So we'll get to a perspective on how much of an impact the book itself, being just one issue, has had on the comic industry as a whole. And that's kind of the goal that we're shooting for. Does that answer your question?
It does.
And it's touted that there'll be an introduction by G.I. Joe podcaster, author, and comic shop owner Tim Finn. This sounds very exciting.
I'm not sure where that came from, but...
Josh asked me 2 or 3 months ago if I would contribute a 1,000-word essay, and maybe it could be longer as the page count...
fluctuates a bit.
Evolves. And he and I will be providing remarks on 4 key pages. And Josh was really excited about this book and was describing it to me as something that he and Roger could do faster than some of the previous After Action reports, because he was so excited because it's much more focused. You know, it is one comic book and it's many iterations and sort of successions, rather than, you know, 10 years of comics or 10 other years of comics. And also I think Josh was thinking somewhat about not quite an anniversary of the issue, but an anniversary of the issue.
It's the 40th anniversary when it gets down to it. So. Yeah,
that's it. I keep thinking of the 40th anniversary of Real American Hero, but 2 years later came issue 21, and I know I'm holding it up right now.
Yeah, and 21, it's the cover date on it is March of 83, but I guess it was March of 84, really, but that it was released in December of 83, I believe, so... We're right there at the 40th anniversary of it.
Yes, according to the internet, it's telling me that it was released December 6th, 1983, and that it's cover date. So I'm straddling two worlds here, listeners and viewers, because I am both interviewing Roger with Mark to ask about this book, and I am also sort of standing next to Roger to talk about being in this book. And initially I thought, I don't know how much I have to say about this. And then, and then sort of a little mark appeared on my shoulder saying, no, you can always say a lot about
anything.
You know, one panel in some issue of G.I. Joe. And I sort of thought, oh, maybe I just need to sort of talk it out, like while I'm doing the dishes, or brainstorm, as opposed to sit down and try and type an essay. I can fill 1,000 words on this. I can fill 2,000 words on this. I also don't want to overlap so much with other things that are showing up in the book. So you get a book, you know, like you get some nice collection of some famous Batman story, or you know, the first year or two of Amazing Spider-Man, and there's an introduction by, you know, the writer who was there or the editor who was there or someone who's involved with that character now many, many years later. And sometimes that introduction is a really nice piece of fluff that's really just to sort of pat you on the back and say, isn't this all great? We're happy. And sometimes it's someone who's providing some commentary, like, I remember when so-and-so pitched the idea and we knew that so-and-so wasn't going to work. I sort of wrote a longer version of this introduction and am now hacking away at it, but trying to offer a little perspective that is entertaining and also makes me look really smart.
Yeah, and I like what you said about not overlapping, because that was one of my own issues with this book. While I was tying up the loose ends on volume 3 in Command Files, Josh didn't really have much to do, so he kind of put this book together on his own, almost in secret, and then kind of presented it whole cloth. You know, still needs a heavy edit and everything, but it's right there and practically done. And he's like, okay, now what do you want to write about it? And I'm like, what did you leave me? I mean, you pretty well covered everything. So, yeah, had to figure out what I was going to write about it. So
yeah, I mean, it's a, and we got a great comment here, doing the job. I don't know how we'd pronounce this. Spantpt. Yeah. give me your best guesses, but
S-P-A-N-P-T.
Yeah, let's go for that.
There you go.
Span-PT, maybe. Yeah. Okay. Sold. I just pledged, guys. That's fantastic stuff. So Roger, what, you know, given the animated way in which Josh has thrown himself at this one, what is your main what have you found your main role being in terms of getting this all to come together?
Primarily editing. That's really, really where I fall into this when it gets down to it. Josh tends to spew a lot of words on the page, and then I got to correct. I got to correct his punctuation, things like that. So, but yeah, it's primarily editing and getting it reorganized a little bit. Beyond that, it was, like I said, almost presented to me whole cloth, and I don't really have much to add to it aside from my own article, but that'll be it. It's Josh's baby, and I'm just going to edit through it and see what we can clean up.
Yeah, I'm going on a tangent here now, but one of the curious things for me about the issue is surrounding, you know, we know the story of how it came about, that essentially editor Danny O'Neill realized that there was a gap in the schedule, that there was an issue that either hadn't been produced or was lost in the pile of chaos on his desk, which meant that they had to turn around a brand new issue very quickly. And I was just, I've always been struck about how much exposition happens in issue 22. Mm-hmm. There are these great swathes of dialogue sort of explaining away what had happened in the previous issue. It's like, say, Scarlet, you know, it's great that you're back from that thing where you were trapped in the castle, and sort of quite unusually large, you know, these large dialogue balloons and so on. So I think there's some interesting elements of trying to make the subsequent issue fit into the grand scheme following this late insert of issue 21.
Yeah. In terms of the story itself, it does seem kind of out of the blue, because suddenly Scarlet's captured and there's this white ninja running around. You know, where'd that come from?
It's funny because there are two kinds of fill-in issues at Marvel in the 80s. Mm. There's the issue that's an inventory issue, mm-hmm. where if the regular team is running behind, another team has produced a self-contained issue.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's kind of a tryout for a writer or a penciler. And
interestingly, the one leading into it, issue 20, is one of those inventory issues.
Mm. Which speaks to, you know, what a challenging book this was to keep on schedule because of, you know, a lot of characters, scheduling of artists, approvals from Hasbro, and maybe lightly sort of trying to line up issues with toy releases. But
lately,
right?
Yeah, almost slavishly.
And then there's the kind of fill-in issue where the regular artist isn't available, and so someone else draws an issue. And sometimes, depending on the book, you sort of get the sense that perhaps the story for that Marvel comic is a little different than it might have been had the regular artist sort of been ready to start that issue at the regular time. And maybe what's happening here is the regular writer is writing a slightly different kind of story that can be self-contained. And then sort of with the next issue, as the regular artist sort of comes back into the rotation. And this reads like the latter in terms of this reads like both. It reads like this issue had been, I'm not saying this issue was made ahead of time. It was not, but to your point that sort of out of nowhere, Scarlet is already captured. That feels like either something that a different writer might do, like, oh, I'll just have one of the Joes captured. And then by the end, they're uncaptured. Or Larry's thinking, I need to start this in the middle. So it's really exciting. Let's not have her get captured. She has been captured.
And
then, you know, the artist is not the regular series artist. And then it acts as a self-contained issue in that, you know, by the end of it, sort of everyone's sort of back where they were so that the next issue, the normal stuff can pick up again. And maybe characters refer to it or not. It reminds me a little bit of how Marvel US was publishing Transformers stories. Those were getting published pretty quickly in the UK, and the UK would catch up with Marvel and then would need to create its own material to fill the next few issues of Transformers UK. And so the writer, Simon Furman, and artists there would make stories where they were just sort of guessing and hoping and like carefully using characters and scenarios. It's like, okay, if someone gets injured in the story, we'll have them back to normal by the end, because in a few weeks we might be republishing an American issue where this character does something and they need to be ready to go. Or we'll use some characters that are off to the side that don't get used in the American story.
Yeah, or like with Star Wars, where suddenly Empire Strikes Back came out and they had to make the story fit. It's like, oh, wait, let's how do we get them to a Hoth, to an ice planet to begin
the story? Josh had suggested when he was perhaps available to join us for this episode that we... look at a page, not one of the four that'll be looked at in the book, but we look at a page and we provide some commentary. We talk about it.
I was just going to put a nail in the point that you're making earlier about those sort of those quick fill-in issues would typically be less important, I guess, particularly if they're inventory and, you know, have to be adaptable enough that they can fit in anywhere. Whereas this is the, I guess, the complete opposite of that, of one of the most important G.I. Joe stories. And strangely enough, there was issue 143, Dark Island, which was this terrible, in my opinion, completely the worst issue out of the original 155, which was, you know, it was an inventory story about Scarlet in the very early days of G.I. Joe, with this framing device of having Scarlet in her ninja force garb in present day, looking back to a previous mission to try and make it fit in better to the current day issues. And presumably this issue was an inventory issue that would have been produced prior to issue 21 being available, and they chose not to run it. I wonder, did they either forget about it or realize or think to themselves that it's not quite of the quality that they would want to run that inventory issue.
I think it's the latter. Hasn't artist Tom Mandrake said, you know, that was some of my first work in 82, 83. I didn't do a great job. I was really surprised when all of a sudden 10 years later they published it. I don't think this is a damning, horrible statement. Like, they had an issue, they wasted it, it wasn't good enough. Take that, Tom Mandrake. I think, the Jim Shooter editor-in-chief era at Marvel, you know, if you look on original art websites, there are lots of pages. There are some pages that got redrawn, and there are lots of covers that got redrawn, you know, like the cover to X Factor number one. The one that they ran was the second one that was drawn. And just this week I found randomly, I think Facebook showed me like a John Byrne fan page that I could join. And it's like, here's a John Byrne cover that either Byrne rejected himself or Jim Shooter rejected. And Shooter was very much about issues being accessible and covers being the best they could be. So, it's surprising, but not shocking that there's a whole issue of G.I. Joe. And there's actually a whole nother issue of G.I. Joe, a fill-in that, from like the second year, I'm looking at a folder with all of the pencils over there right now, hasn't really surfaced. And, that one, I don't think there is much of a story. Like it was good enough or it wasn't, but this kind of thing, did happen. And, I think that, I think Mike Lackey, who was the editor of G.I. Joe for its final year, had said, cause he was, I think, an editor at Conan around the time that G.I. Joe was wrapping up. And I think he said to me by email that, you know, the Conan office had many inventory stories that they didn't get around to publishing. Because if you were an editor, I'm extrapolating here. This was a low impact way to try out a new artist.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I'm going to send you a plot. Can you pencil these, you know, 20 or 22 pages? If I need it, I can use it. Or if it's good, I'll get a good inker to ink it, or maybe not. Or if it's bad, I'll get a good inker to fix it. Marvel even 15 years ago published four sort of random inventory issues under the headline of From the Marvel Vault.
Okay.
There was like an X-Men story that I think it was published in X-Men Gold, which was sort of an anniversary special. There was a New Mutants inventory issue. I don't remember what else it was, but you know, they had been sitting around and they got colored, you know, now in like modern 2010, 2015 colors. And they were all sort of oddball issues because, you know, someone might be referring to something that was happening in 1986, but also by the end of the issue, you know, it's not like Storm now has a red costume and lives on Pluto or something. It's like, no, Storm sort of goes back to the mansion by the end of the issue.
Yeah, that, I think DC, that speaks to the shelf life of those inventory issues, because they're only good for like a year or 2 years at most, for the most part, because
but unless you create a framing sequence.
Yeah, yeah.
Where Scarlet in her modern costume says, I remember this one time.
Exactly. Which was so painfully obvious on that issue. Yeah, really, it really was obvious that G.I. Joe was winding down for Marvel, and they were like, well, let's use some back stock and just put it out. Let's not put some effort into this one. So, and I think they used like three inventory issues in that last 10 issues.
Getting back to Silent Interlude, Mark, what is this art behind you?
Yeah. This is, let me,
can you go, full, go screen?
Full screen? Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is,
lovely.
Larry Hammer sketch.
The original pencil sketch on the left?
Original pencils by Larry Hammer that I got from him at a rollout roll call convention in the UK.
Okay.
And he just had it. He had it sitting on his desk at the time that he'd sort of pre-done. And I said to him, "Are you selling this?" And he's like, "Well, do you want to buy it?" And I'm like, "Yes." And then I know Larry isn't keen on people sort of doing anything further with his sketches, but I did get Inca extraordinaire Guillermo Ortego to take a copy of it and then sort of do like finishes and inks on it. So what I've got is a Larry Hama original tribute to issue 21 and an inked cover quality pretty much, although it's a reduced size finished by Guillermo Ortego.
The logo and corner box and the burst, are those part of that original art ink?
That's created in the ink, yes.
Okay.
So it is physical media and added on by hand by the inker to finish it off and give it that cover quality. Cool. So, that's my little piece of issue 21 history.
Yeah.
Did you have a page that you suggested that we could have a quick look at and discuss?
Roger, can you quickly remind us what four pages are getting commented on in the book so that we can pick? I think I'm looking for the PDF that. Okay, here it is. Hold on. I'm opening up the PDF now.
Yeah. I think page two is in there.
All right, the commentary is on. Oh, they're question marks. 2/18/2022. All right, so let's just pick something between 3, 4, 5.
So that is one.
How about 8, where with the barrette, the hairpin, the bobby pin?
Yeah.
Okay.
And 8, 9, 10. How about 11? Back outside with Snake Eyes versus the two.
Okay. So I've put on the screen that page of Scarlet in the oubliette with the bobby pin moment.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jason, for your comments. Glad you're hanging out.
When Hama spoke to my students in, I think it was 2012, and he read through Silent Interlude and talked about it, he got to this page and he said, I don't know if these are still used. People know what bobby pins are?
I believe they are still used.
And I think my only two experiences with bobby pins, I haven't really known, I didn't have classmates who used them or lost them. I'm sure I saw one, at a mall or on someone's head and sort of understood what it is. But actually my two real exposures to bobby pins are in this comic book.
Okay.
And in, I think it's 1957. I forget the year, but the Chuck Jones Bugs Bunny cartoon, Water Every Hair, which is a really awesome and strange cartoon where Bugs Bunny's asleep and it's raining and his home underground floods and the current sweeps him into a castle, a mad scientist's lair, and the big monster who's just sort of red hair and two sneakers Bugs is doing this bit where he's a hairdresser to distract the monster and
down the hair.
His dialogue is something like, it's like, I can't believe how wonderful it is. Bobby pins, please. And he and the monster like takes one and hands it to Bugs, and Bugs I think bites it and sort of bends it or opens it and then
something like
clamps
that.
The hair down and clamps the hair down. So as with a lot of actors and sort of cultural touch points, I never knew who like the Marx Brothers were until much later. But I would see a cartoon character do a Groucho impression, or you see someone with the glasses, with the nose and the mustache. So between G.I. Joe and Chuck Jones, Looney Tune.
You know what a bobby pin is.
I know what a bobby pin is. It's vital if I'm going to get out of handcuffs.
Yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. But sadly, like you have no place to hide one.
Burn.
So sometimes I let the beard go.
Okay, fair enough.
What would Mark? What would you like to say about this page?
So I guess you know, like any page from this issue, it's just about perfect. I'd say we can say that in terms of how this was prepared that Larry has described that he would create almost like the panels first, the shape of the panels, and then figure out what's going to go in them next. And that kind of, you know, somewhat dictates the kind of the compositional approach that he takes. And we're seeing, you know, this real clarity of storytelling on the top, a sort of a long shot of Scarlett sort of reaching into her hair, a closer up of her face, that showing the bobby pin as a single panel, you know, ultra clear. This is what's going on. No chance of it. A confusion there, and then picking the lock before. And in that sequence, she's in the oubliette dungeon, which helps in terms of speed of drawing the thing, because there's no background in these panels. So it's you know, when we're looking across these pages, it's a common theme. You know, that some of the backgrounds have got clever shortcuts or of sort of very simple. And then we've got Larry doing some sort of great perspective of Snake Eyes descending, again, long shots, action shots, and then interesting perspective angles looking up from below that trooper's chin as Snake Eyes is kind of descending down upon him.
Yeah, and just like Larry's head said about the opening panel with the establishing shot of the architecture, you know exactly where they're at throughout this whole sequence because of those angles and you don't quite know where she is within it, but you can assume she's down in the basement, and where he's located is obvious right from the very first panel because he's climbing down the snake that's on the peak of it.
Roger, so, you're comparing these bottom three panels to page one.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah.
When I look at this page, I am struck by the symmetry of it. Mm-hmm. You can divide it up, down, or left, right, and the panels are symmetrical. I'm struck by how subtly and certainly inadvertently a couple of these pages start to look a little bit like the Arashikage symbol.
Yeah. Yeah, you kind of get that impression a little bit. And that was probably subconscious on his part. I don't think he was thinking along those lines yet.
And I mean, you know, we could pick several things that lots of comic book pages, if we're just looking at empty panels, start to look like. They look like flags, or, you know, they look like the ridges on a manhole cover. I look at this page and... If you like to draw, and you like to draw sort of fun, flashy things like people or robots in action poses, you might not want to draw sort of everyday fiction stuff like chains and handcuffs. Mm-hmm. Like those are a drag, or or bobby pins.
But they're necessary for the story.
Yeah. You know, I've said before, comics are the hardest thing to draw because you have to be able to do everything. Perspective, anatomy, acting, action, horses, motorcycles, castles, you know, skeletons, props, and you know, all kinds of props. And if you just said to someone, draw a bobby pin, it's like, well, that's easy. It's not as hard as a skeleton. But I think there's
architecture to it.
There's so much embedded skill in Hama's drawing, in his penciling, not just his storytelling, because we get really properly hung up on his storytelling, his layout, his panel layout, his page layout, sometimes I have to remind myself just how handsome this issue is. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I recognize, and Hama has said this, you know, he said, I don't draw in a flashy modern style. And yeah. I think he's sort of implying he also wasn't doing it then. Back then, the difference between sort of how Hama drew in the 70s or 80s and like the flashiest styles of the day was much smaller. But so here is this perfectly drawn bobby pin, and the shading and inking on the handcuff and the chains, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, that says metallic. That's how you ink something to be shiny metal. And a subtle thing, you know, sometimes when I read X-Men comics, I'm really aware of how the characters in their costumes, they've just sort of been drawn naked. And then there's like a line here on the wrist to show where, like, well, their hand versus their sleeve, like flesh versus, you know, tight spandex or yeah, like,
exactly.
You know,
and here you actually see the seams on the gloves and stuff like that.
Yes. Yes. She, you know, she's wearing cloth, that Cobra soldier on the bottom right. That's a cloth mask. There's no shorthand for that. And there's no sort of stylistic simplification or shorthand for that. And I also, in that second panel, there are many artists who have drawn at Marvel and some other publishers where I feel like 9 out of 10 times I could pick them out in like, oh, so-and-so penciled this, or, I think this is the page where a different inker, flip back the credits. Yeah. This is where the inker changes from the first inker to the second inker. Yeah. And partly because Hama hasn't drawn many comics that I've read, and partly because his style isn't flashy, I've always had a little bit of a blind spot for his style.
Yeah.
I think also, you know, a lot of different inkers have worked on him, but, you know, like we've read probably dozens and dozens and dozens of comics by a Rod Wiggum or a John Byrne, and a dozen drawn by Larry Hama. But in the last like 10 years, I've started to pick out how he draws eyes.
Okay.
And this second panel, it's like, okay, yep, Larry Hama drew that.
Yeah. Eyes are probably the easiest thing to pick out, especially in faces.
Hmm.
Yeah. Everything else kind of blends together, but I think eyes are very unique to the artist.
And I guess as well, because the way that Hama pencils, he leaves more room for an inker to finish the work, mm-hmm. that his stamp on it is slightly less pronounced versus some other artists.
Right. Hama has described the difference between thumbnails and breakdowns and full pencils. He's posted about this occasionally on Facebook, and, you know, full pencils is what we think of, I think, most often, where, you know, whatever the publisher, whatever the era, you could almost just scan it, darken it, and that works like the inks. Thumbnails are more like not stick figures, like actual thin lines, but sort of mannequins.
Yeah.
And then for Hama, breakdowns are halfway between thumbnails and full pencils, where he's leaving some decisions up to the inker, like line weight and some textures, but he's knocking in most of the information. And if I've got this right, Hama's G.I. Joe cover sketches mm-hmm. are thumbnails. All of the pencil art for this issue 21 are breakdowns.
Yeah, that's my impression of it. Yeah.
And we've got the photocopies of the pencils in the back of that hardcover edition that was published by IDW.
Yes.
IDW. Which kind of lets us know kind of how much Hama did do on most of these pencils, these pages, and you can see that most of the information is there, and the panels are really let me find this.
That's cool,
Yeah. So we can see this page on the screen now. So the, you know, all of the composition is there, you know, the figures, the perspective, and it's really just the fine details, the textures, line weights, etc., that is being definitely being finished by Steve Lealoa in the inks.
I had my headphones off for a second. These breakdowns have been published twice in this, right?
I think that was the only time, wasn't it? In that one.
I feel you've got the hardback, right? In the hardback.
Weren't they also in the 40th anniversary?
That's not the 40th anniversary? I thought that was.
No, this is the 30th anniversary.
Oh, that's the 30th. Okay.
This is the skinny one. Aren't they also in... Are they in the Rise of Serpentor, or are they in the big hardcover?
I don't have the big hardcovers myself. Josh would have them, but
I don't mean oversized.
No, I mean the thicker one.
IDW, right at the end of its license, republished the 40th anniversary issue as a hardcover, and I think they did include. I can't remember.
I would think it's in the hardcover, but I don't. I don't own the hardcover myself. So.
I'm always embarrassed when we're doing an episode and there's some G.I. Joe question and my answer is I don't remember.
I've got a feeling it wasn't. If anyone is watching live and knows the answer for sure as to whether those pencils were included in the 40th thicker hardcover, let us know. Tim has just exited across the room. We had a question from Obi-Wana asking if Larry Hammer. There's a question there, Tim. Was Larry Hammer talking with your students in 2012? That was corrected. 2012 in Louisville. I think I was there. So I think that you're talking about him in Somerville,
In Boston.
In Boston.
Hama has at several conventions in the last 10 or 15 years for his panel on storytelling just talked through every page of issue 21.
Yeah.
And he did that when he came to the university where I have taught in Boston. And this was a Friday night. This was a school visit at a sort of conference room at the school. But you may have been at a convention where he did the same kind of talk.
Yes,
he did. A similar one on one of his appearances in the UK at Rollout Roll Call. Did you find out the answer from looking across the other side of the room, Tim?
I grabbed the Rise of Serpentor hardcover. IDW published two hardcovers right at the end of 2023. One was kind of a best of. It is not in here, and I feel like I looked at, because wasn't I, when we were reviewing the actual 40th anniversary single issue, wasn't I saying this should have had the thumbnails in it? And then I feel like I was looking at the hardcover collection of that, the 40th anniversary hardcover, just a week ago at my shop, and I think it does include them. Okay. Shall we look at another page?
Sure.
Yeah.
Which one are we looking at?
This was 8, right? So now we're going to
11. Is that what you said?
9, 10. Yeah. You want to talk about 11?
This one on the turrets.
Yeah.
There's a fancy word for turrets. is it? I think it might begin with a C.
Oh wait, I had this in my essay that I hold on. Let me because Hama used the word because I was watching the video of him talking to my students. Anyway, it's okay. So my first impression when looking at the page is I'm actually really aware of the color and how much I appreciate old four color printing on newsprint. As nice as Digital Chameleon did on remastering this page.
There's something richer about the original than there is about the reprint. Yeah.
Yeah. The, you know, this light purple behind Snake Eyes in the first panel and the yellow orange of the actual, you know, castle stone.
Yeah.
Versus the dark blue of Snake Eyes and the Cobra Soldiers. You know, there's all this variation in that orange, in that lavender, in that sort of magenta. And when you, it's two things. One, when you pick the actual color that it's meant to be in Photoshop, like, you know.
Yeah, and fill that whole space with it.
And it, and it's pure and uniform, and it's on glossy paper, and it's like any one molecule of it, any one sort of square millimeter of it as like 50% yellow and 25% magenta is the exact same as anywhere else.
Yeah.
It's not harsh, but it's a little loud.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the analogy that I've been thinking of is it's sort of like, well, I'll skip that analogy, but I see vibration in this irregularity, and I find that really pleasing. And I will note that in the 80s, when I was getting these back issues, you know, all the G.I. Joe issues from 2 to, I forget when it switches to the nicer newsprint. I don't know, the 70s or 80s?
Paper comes in number 37, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, it switches from the newsprint. Oh, number 1 was Baxter. Paper. And then the rest up to 36 were regular newsprint, like everything else, I think.
Okay.
And then Mondo Paper, which was sort of halfway between newsprint and Baxter.
But the printing switches, because the, like, the yellows are really, really harsh in the some of the Rod Wiggum issues. Mm-hmm. And then the palette increases. It goes, I think this is when they get not just 25 and 50 and 100% percentages of CMYK, but also the 75%. Because somewhere in the 70s or 80s, like, I'm thinking of how Bob Sharon colors Viper helmets during Mark Bright issues, and there's this light blue one. Anyway, what am I saying?
Something about color.
When I was buying these back issues, I was always disappointed when I would get an issue on newsprint, or, you know, like Punisher War Journal at $1.50 or $1.75 was on nicer paper than Punisher, which was on newsprint. And now I totally appreciate, because the brightness of the white of the paper is not any brighter than the brightest yellow or brightest blue or brightest whatever. And on glossy paper,
that white is harsh now.
The white is harsh. And if a re-separator does 100% yellow, I think sort of the relative harshness goes up. It's sort of loud for my eye. And so I'm still talking about color. I haven't talked about composition or action or like drama. But what I really wanted to say was that the background color drops out in the fourth panel. That's cool. There's a punctuation on that, because this moment, you know, like if this was a movie, you might drop out all the music and sounds just for a moment as Snake Eyes throws the dagger. The sort of red, that, like, the little spots of red that jump from mask to mask to cobra symbol to mask. It's just, the color is really handsome, and there's so much you can do with limited color, and there can be such a pleasing overall look and feel to old color on newsprint.
Yeah. And I'll try not to get as in depth, but
and I will apologize for being so in depth.
Yeah, it feels to me like the original print is nighttime. The new print doesn't look like nighttime anymore. It looks like well lit daylight.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So that muted tone really makes it feels like shadows and the environment that it's meant to be in. The brighter colors don't feel that way anymore. But what you were saying about the vibration of the difference colors, that to me, brings it to life a little bit, because it forces your eye to make it feel as though it's moving.
Yeah.
Whereas the solid color doesn't. It's just a flat plane. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No.
I think I've got five things to say about this page. Okay. first one is that Larry Hammer thing of keeping track of you know, weaponry and kit and all of these kind of things. And yeah. Panel one, he's deliberately placing that Uzi on the top of the battlements, and you know, yes, keeping track of what's where. He's got a knife on him, and you know, he's using that up. That's gonna be off his person in a second. Mm-hmm. The other thing is then sort of seeing the original art against the published page. How much of some of that detail, particularly on a black figure like Snake Eyes, gets lost in the muddy printing? So if you look at panel three. Original art versus printed, which sort of getting a little bit muddier and losing some of the fine detail of the what's on the page. The next bit is the final panels of this page. You've got Snake Eyes drawn quite differently with these sort of finer lines and that blurred effect showing him in movement, and a lot of artists don't necessarily get the impact of being able to draw a character in movements. So you're seeing him sort of throw that dagger, and you're really getting a sense of that kinetic energy from Snake Eyes. And then the final point was, again, it's one of Larry Hammer's strength, which is the reality of kind of physical movement, which is we're thinking about how he's going to move from one position to another, and the characters are going to interact. So he's throwing that dagger forward, and then he's bringing his arm back down the other side in that final panel, in that kind
to
of
to knock the AK-47 out of the Cobra soldier's hands, and he hits them so hard his helmet pops off.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I can add to everything Mark just said, not only is the Uzi at the top of panel one, but the rope that we saw previously is at the top of panel one as well on the right. And we see the Uzi and the rope again in panel three.
Correct.
Because Hama's not losing track of it. And Snake Eyes is going to grab one of them right after this page.
Yes.
Mark, your point about thank you. The speed lines, the inking within Snake Eyes on these final two panels, they're directional. And I don't know when Hama starts seeing manga as an influence, like buying Japanese comics published in Japanese at bookstores in like Little Tokyo or Chinatown in New York City, and starting to look at those and show those to his studio mates, or bringing those to the office.
In Krusty Bunkers, wasn't it?
It also happens later with Lone Wolf and Cub when he's at a Marvel editor. But yes, he has talked about bringing them to Neil Adams Continuity Studios. But I feel like this inking on Snake Eyes here is showing some Eastern influence. But then also look at the inking on this Cobra soldier all the way on the bottom left, and these really gorgeous directional lines on that top arm, on his leg. Let me compare this to Hama's breakdowns in this book that I grabbed, because they're not there. So this is Steve Leiloa.
Okay.
A little closer.
Yeah.
And all right, it's starting to be there on Snake Eyes in that fourth panel, but it's left open on the Cobra soldier in the final panel. And then Mark made this point earlier about Hama starting the writing process as just dividing pages into empty panel shapes, which are going to suggest shots, like camera placement and distance, and rough blocking. Like, well, this panel, if it's, you know, if it's thin and rectangular, it's a horizontal movement. Maybe there's someone rushing or slashing, or this panel is tall and skinny. This might be someone just looking at us, or someone kneeling and reacting, or someone kneeling and taking a bobby pin out of their hair. And Hama's, you know, sometimes I talk about design when we're looking at comics, and I'm talking very much about geometric shapes. And some artists like Dave Johnson, who are drawing less with lines, the way that like a Jim Lee or David Finch is drawing, you know, detailed lines of texture, and more about sort of big like circles and cylinders and octagons. But design is still very much about not just an arrangement of shapes in how characters are posed and taking up space, but also how they overlap. And this final panel, both these panels, every panel in the book, but this final panel here, everything is so thoughtfully laid out. And I think some of it is Hama thinking and making a decision. And I think a lot of it is Hama is just already very good at it and has really good instincts. And if he's motivated by a tough deadline, if he puts something down, it's more likely to be good than not. But this final panel, the little diagonal of the battlement on the left that overlaps with the helmet and the bit of the AK-47, the AK-47's in front of the other battlement, the Cobra soldier's knee, where the helmet, the AK-47, the Cobra soldier's hand, his right hand, right in front of the butt, and then the speed lines, and then Snake Eyes' hand, and this perspective, this foreshortening on this Cobra soldier's body, and how we see Snake Eyes' hand on one side in the negative space, but his whole body on the other side, but then he's behind some speed lines. And then I could do this all over again for the other soldiers: hand, dagger, machine gun, belt pouch, torso, even down to the little bit of helmet that's all the way off the panel on the right side. Mm-hmm. This is such a strong compositional arrangement. And, you know, this is not like a splash page. This is not a cover. This is just one more bit of an action scene.
Yeah.
To Mark's point about the details that we lose in panel 3, because of the old printing, right? Newsprint is really absorptive, and ink bleeds. And so it's easy for me to say, as a purist or like an old school comics fan, or, well, I like limited color and old comics had limited color. It's easy for me to say, I wish it was always on newsprint. And that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you can recreate the look on the left if you remaster, if you make a new master, if you scan the original art or scan a really good copy, the original film or a stat of the original art, and you prepare new color files, because it's the modern era and everything's going through like Photoshop or into InDesign, and it's all PDFs, right? You're sending a digital file to the printer. You're not sending stacks and stacks of of film.
Yeah.
You can replicate the color of that not bright white bleached glossy paper. You can replicate the color of that slightly yellowed or browned newsprint. You can dull the yellow, even though it wants to be like 100% saturation. You can dull it to 90%, and on a modern paper, it won't be louder or brighter. You know, Skybound just reprinted G.I. Joe number one, A Real American Hero number one, on newsprint, which is really funny in a way, because G.I. Joe number one has not been printed on newsprint. It was printed on Baxter paper originally because it was a deluxe book. And then Tales of G.I. Joe, and there is no proper second print, right? Other issues got second prints. G.I. Joe number one, as Tales of G.I. Joe, that whole series was on Baxter paper. So issue one has been on newsprint in digest form, right? G.I. Joe Comics Magazine digest, which was Archie sized. And that includes issues one and two. That whole series, which got up into the 30s, as reprints. That's on newsprint. So I find I'm not saying anyone at Skybound sort of misremembered, but Skybound has been experimenting because a year ago, the publisher republished The Walking Dead Deluxe number one, right? This is the color edition, which 3 years ago was on glossy paper. And there's a new edition, which is on newsprint. And it's an interesting comparison. And I don't think it's better. I think Dave McCaig, who colors all of The Walking Dead Deluxe, is like doing it with a certain approach that on glossy paper, it makes sense. So doing it on newsprint doesn't like add a whole bunch or take away a whole bunch. I think it's just a little different.
Yeah.
But Taschen, the very fancy European publisher, has done these ultra deluxe hardcover reprints of 1960s Marvel comics. The series is technically called Marvel Comics Library, and each book collects 2 years straight of Amazing Spider-Man, first 2 years, the second 2 years, Avengers, the first 2 years, Silver Surfer, the first 16 issues, Fantastic Four, and I think there's an X-Men one. So they've done about eight of these huge $200 hardcovers, and they're not using the files that Marvel uses for its Masterworks or its Remasterworks or the Mighty Marvel Masterworks, the smaller ones, or the facsimile editions, or the Epic collections. Taschen scanned or photographed printed comics, like the first 40 issues of Amazing Spider-Man, and then did some light Photoshop adjusting to like get the levels, and found a paper that's like newsprint. And so you get this book. If you're at my store, we've got one on the counter. You can just flip through it. We have it out of the box. And that's how we sell it. Because people, one in 30 people sees it and they're like, well, I got to own this now. And then they walk out. And it's great because the first 20 pages are essays on modern glossy paper. And then you get to the cover of the first issue and it's on a thicker glossy stock. And then you get to the first page and it's on not technically newsprint, but a paper now that's very much like newsprint.
Okay.
And then you read that whole comic and then you get to the back cover and that's again on a glossy, thicker stock. And so even though it's bound and it's oversized and it weighs 5 pounds, it's actually of all of the reprints that anyone has done, yes, even including the facsimile editions, the most like reading the actual comic book. And okay. I'm not saying Skybound, whoever has to like mix paper stocks within one edition, but just in terms of Photoshop, you can get even closer than the nice job that Digital Chameleon did on the first 50 issues when it prepared new files for Marvel's collections of G.I. Joe Volume 1 through 5 back in 2001-2002.
Yeah, nice.
I was just going to add that if you enjoyed this discussion, a deep dive into looking at the original pages, Tim and I did do an episode with Gene Park where we did a flick through each and every page, discussing them in great detail. So do go and seek out that previous episode if you want to dig in more.
Roger, do you and Josh point out that in some of the when Hasbro reprinted issue 21, there is no Stan Lee Presents.
Yeah, that's true.
All right.
Yeah.
When IDW reprinted it, at least in this 30th anniversary hardcover,
it goes back. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not a big deal. This is not controversy.
Just interesting.
I mean, now we've seen the previews for the McFarlane Toys. Are they going to be called Page Punchers?
I believe they are Page Punchers, yeah.
Okay, so they're $15. It's a two-pack. Is it 5 points of articulation?
No, I think they're 3 or 4 points, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so,
well, maybe it's five. Maybe it's
might be five heads, yeah, arms,
shoulders, like, yeah, thighs. So it's going to come with two figures and two comic books.
Yes.
And
yes,
so far, it seems to be kind of recent IDW issues.
Yeah, I think all four of them are IDW issues. I know, and one of them was the annual with all the Crimson Guard on the cover.
Right, 2012.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, the files that IDW was printing, they say IDW on the cover, and you know, McFarlane Toys isn't gonna, you know, take that off, or they slightly move up, or they white out part of the, yeah, the corner box, the same way that when Skybound inevitably reprints the Marvel issues, the IDW issues, maybe the Devil's Due issues, you know, they will certainly take that out. So this Stan Lee thing is not interesting. It's just one more detail.
Yeah.
In a book filled with details about differences.
What do you focus on when it gets down to
it? Exactly. Let's remind viewers and listeners about this particular campaign. So we are talking about the history of G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, issue 21, an after action report book.
Yes, it is.
That's the full name. So if you just type in Google after action report 21, I think it will pop up, but yeah, it's early. Also, so it's search up optimization is working. What can people actually get in this campaign?
Right now it is funded, so you'll get the book itself. Our next stretch goal is the set of prints, I believe. We've gone through several iterations of what order everything goes, so forgive me if I get it out of order. But the stretch goals will be a set of prints. That'll be all the front and back covers of all the books we've done up to this point. And I think one or two other things, like the map that's included in command files. I think we're including that one. We'll do a new dog tag for the next one. The Brian Sawyer minimalist stickers is one of them. We might still try to get like Steve Lealoa or somebody else to do a cover if we reach, I think, 1600, basically double where we're at now. But we're not certain about that. We may drop that just because we've got a great cover already and people seem to like it. So, you know, why tempt fate? Yeah, that's basically it. You'll get the book. You'll get if we reach all the stretch goals, it'll be the prints, the dog tags, and the stickers. One of the things you can pledge towards is the fan love page. You can write 200 words on what G.I. Joe number 21 means to you, or how it impacted your life, or you know, whatever you want to say about it in roughly 200 words. That is one of the options when you're purchasing the book and pledging towards it.
And if someone has if someone has missed a previous after action report, it looks like they can add that on.
Yes, you can order all the books on top of this as well, so you can get them all at once when they arrive. That should be about it. I'm not sure there's anything more. I think you can order them individually or as a set. I think we have both options.
So. Yeah, and there's if you're new to the world of After Action Reports, it looks like there's an all-in $120, which gets you the three main books plus this new one.
Yeah.
So, and the standard price for the latest one on its own, $35, and the extra is with your story included, where you can add in 200 words of your own, is a $50 option.
Yes, I believe that's almost tapped out.
When,
so if you want to say something about
all right,
it, say
well
it
done.
when Josh Eggebean first contacted me to be a small contributor to this book, I thought, is there enough to say about this between, you know, not just me, but Roger and Josh and the people who made the issue, you know, sort of culling interview comments or including profiles of their work and their other work. I thought, is there enough really to fill an issue, an after action report publication just on this one comic?
Yes.
And if so, is it worth it?
Yeah.
And it didn't take me long to realize that Josh Eggbein and Roger Taft are the people to put this together. I feel not just like it's a nice idea, but also delighted to be able to contribute to spend 1,000 words or maybe 2,000 on reflecting on this issue and to collate all in one place the history of the issue, its significance, its legacy, its publication history, this article about the mystery of the second printing. And, you know, if not for, you know, what issue of G.I. Joe deserves, how many pages is this? 40, 40, 60?
I think we're at 88 pages right now. I know it's right around 80 anyway.
All right. I'm looking at my preview PDF and it goes up to 80.
And I think we're at 88 right now.
Celebrate just a little late. Celebrate the 40th anniversary of Silent Interlude with this really interesting book.
Yeah. Well, if you're questioning whether or not there's enough to talk about, we've just talked for an hour and a half, basically on two pages. So I'm thinking we can fill a book.
Most definitely. So, thanks. Thanks, Roger. Thanks, Tim. And thanks to listeners for spending some time with us. Just a reminder, on the screen is afteractionreport.net. I think that is the so you just type in afteractionreport.net, return, and that will get you there, and that will get you links to all of the existing campaigns, plus a link to the Kickstarter is there as well.
If you want more consistent updates, you can join our Facebook group, After Action Report G.I. Joe Comic Guide is the full name of it. So we post there almost daily.
And I know that you've been thinking about what to do after this one as well, Roger. You've been I think this is public knowledge because you did you did a panel about it, but you've been talking about doing some merchandise books, which sound like it will be fascinating to see, because they're, you know, the wild world of G.I. Joe merchandising is something that's does definitely fascinate me.
Yeah. Well, aside from this book, we've got 3 other books currently in the works, and Josh has taken the lead on the 2 international guidebooks, which is the comics that aren't printed in English. One will be the European comics, and the other will be everywhere else, Asia and South America, etc. I'm taking the lead with Dan Moore with the After Action Report Live the Adventure merchandise book. And that's going to be a hard one. It's going to be a very, very, very hard one. There's no consistency to it like there is with comics. You can't go 1 through 150 or 155. You've got to go.
Dan Moore is a collector of paperwork
and merchandise. He has a lot of between him, me, and a few other people. Drew Haggerty included. We cover the majority of what's out there for merchandise, and to cover what that is, that's the tents, the Halloween costumes, the board games, the card games, the trading cards, the posters, you know, everything that isn't the toys or the comics, essentially, everything that a kid would fill his bedroom with if he was a G.I. Joe fan in the 80s. It's proving to be a very difficult book just to figure out how to even approach. There's no, you know, we know how many issues of G.I. Joe comics there are. We have a pretty good idea how many reprints there are. So we've got that as fact, but how many different companies produce t-shirts? How many t-shirts do they make? What images were on those t-shirts? How do we define that? And that's, it's going to be a very different book than the other books, because it's not, it can't be complete no matter how we approach it. It has to be just sort of a taste of what's out there. So
the best of,
kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Live the adventure, the best of G.I. Joe there merchandise.
Yeah. Cause for example, like every company that's produced G.I. Joe t-shirts, all of them have done a black t-shirt with a Cobra logo on it. So how often do you address that? Do you need every version of that in your collection or in the book? You know, do you even want it in the book?
And it's, you know, a page upon page of the same logo exactly. on the t-shirt's not going to be very exciting versus a bar of soap in the shape of the USS flag, for example.
Exactly. Which there is. So.
I guess with the resurgence of G.I. Joe comics as well, that can only help you guys with the new Skybound era, getting lots of extra eyes on those comics and a sort of uplift in interest in G.I. Joe back issues and stuff. Yeah. The one that I want to see next is IDW, more IDW stuff, because. Yeah. There was, I know that you've done your great hammer time book, but the IDW universe, lots of content, lots of extra variant issues. You could do Snake Eyes Dead Game variant probably as a book on its own.
Yeah, it really is. But, at least a chapter, anyway.
but also just helping readers navigate that complicated publishing order and reading order, probably that more than any other publisher's work is a tricky one because of the different series and the different renumbering and stuff.
Yeah, I think that's one thing we will have to address if and when we get that, because we are likely to do those books as long as there's enough demand for them. We will likely do IDW and in whole. But we'll have to give a flowchart as to how to read that damn thing.
And are you looking at the output of Skybound and rubbing your hands and thinking, "Oh, there's a lot of variance there. That sounds like there's a problem being created, which will need a solution at some point."
Yeah, yeah. On the one hand, yes. On the other hand, they're not far enough along to give us enough content for a book. So it'll be probably minimum 3 years before we can even think about doing a book on Skybound, but because there just isn't enough publication history for it yet. But if it gets there, we'll get there too.
So was there anything else that you guys wanted to mention or shout out before we wrap up?
I think Roger should just once again tell people where to go to pledge for this book.
Absolutely. Head over to Kickstarter. Just type in After Action Report or G.I. Joe 21. Either of those should get you there. I think both of them get there. Or any combination of those words will probably get you there. We've got 12 days left. We have funded, so it will be published. You will get the book if you pledge.
Readers and listeners, if you just heard or saw Roger say 12 days left, it might be many fewer than that.
By the time you watch
or listen to this.
So can you just remind us, what is the cutoff date?
I believe it is March 8th, I think, is the final day. I'm pretty sure that's it. March 8th should be right. So that's from today. That's just under 2 weeks.
So Friday, March the 8th, yes.
Yes, that's correct. So get your bids in. Get your pledges in. If you want to bid on it, great. I mean, we don't mind paying and getting a little more for it. But get your pledges in, and you will get a book. Unlike our previous books, where we only were about halfway through the physical book when we kickstarted, this one's like 90% done already. Really, really, it just needs editing at this point. The other books, we actually had to finish them and then edit them and then get them published. This time we're planning on sending the book to the printer on April 1st, so just a little over a month from now. If that's the case, we should have them, cross your fingers, because who knows what's going to happen, but we should have them by Joe Fest of this summer. So
and Tim, Where can people find you when you are not talking about 40-year-old silence books?
With my creative partners in New York, they run a YouTube page with essays, video essays on TV and film, which is at Atomic Abe. My brick and mortar comic book shop is just outside Boston, Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
Excellent stuff. And if you are new to...
Yeah, I didn't realize if you were at Atomic Abe. My shop was Atomic Age Artifacts.
YouTube. Oh, right. We have this overlap. YouTube.com/ at Atomic Abe is the shortcut for the channel. Mark, where are you and we?
We are at talkingjoe.uk. That is the website with links to all of the places where we are, Facebook, Twitter, links to all of our podcast, YouTube platforms, etc., and also to Patreon. Big thanks to all of our Patreon backers, as always, who get some early access and exclusive content. We are bringing you A Real American Hero, issue 304, as the next episode that will be dropping on Thursday the 29th of February, and those Patreon backers will have access to that as of today. So I think we are done, and just leaves us to say that
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Yay. Laters.